There's many ways we can talk about these Four Noble Truths. The reason why I'm giving a talk on the subject today is simply to follow a long tradition of 25 centuries. Because next Wednesday, the full moon day, is the anniversary of the time when the Buddha gave his first teaching after his enlightenment, which many of you traditional Buddhists would know, was at a place called Sarnath, just outside of Benares, to five former friends who were following the homeless life. And the first talk which he gave was on the subject of the Four Noble Truths. That particular talk which he gave were to people who'd been meditating for a long time, people who'd already abandoned many of the attachments, such as family and belongings. So the talk which the Buddha gave at that occasion was very strong, very deep, and very far-reaching. In fact, it did cause one of the listeners to gain the first stage of enlightenment, and that teaching became the core teaching of Buddhism, of all types of Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths. And so this evening, because of the occasion, very close to the full moon anniversary when the Lord Buddha first gave this talk, it seems appropriate to weave this talk this evening around the Four Noble Truths. First of all, just to say what these Four Noble Truths are, and then I'm going to adapt them to our experience of everyday life. In order for us to have some understanding of what life truly is, what we can expect from it, and how to deal with it, so that we don't get either disappointed, disillusioned, frustrated, and have all of the suffering which these emotions bring to us. In fact, the Four Noble Truths are about suffering, about the experience of human life, especially the unpleasant part of human life. The Buddha said the first noble truth is suffering. He taught why we suffer, the cause. And then he declared that there is an end, there is a way out of this suffering. And the fourth noble truth was teaching the way, teaching the method, the path, what you have to do to get out of suffering. And those particular format was very deep. And it's very true to say that all the teachings of Buddha are about those Four Noble Truths in all sorts of different ways. And this evening, even though I've given a talk on Four Noble Truths many times before, each one will be following a different aspect of this. Because sometimes that during the week and on a Friday evening, on the weekend, that I have to deal with people who come because of some type of suffering. People usually come and speak to the monks, not when they're having a good time, but when there's a problem. When they're going through some sort of difficulty in their life. And so you do hear and see much of the suffering which is there in life. And sometimes people come and ask, why? Why is it that my daughter died when she was so young? Why is it that my wife died, even though we've been married for so long? Why is it that we've parted, that a separation, a divorce has happened? Why is it that I've lost my job? Why is it that I get cancer? I was reading in one book not so long ago, there was a woman who was 96 years of age, who went into hospital. She'd been healthy all her life, and the doctors diagnosed her as having cancer. And her response was, why me? <laughs> 96 years of age. It's a showing that people don't understand something very important, these Four Noble Truths. Because as human beings, we live under an illusion, a misconception, a wrong idea. And that wrong idea is that this human existence, what we call life, as a man or as a woman, in Australia or in wherever, we think that life should be happy, and only happy. And when something goes wrong, We think it shouldn't have gone wrong. We want to blame something or someone, and very often who we blame is ourselves. We feel guilty, we feel sad about something basically which we have no control over. So often people feel guilty when something goes wrong. When somebody dies, we think, if only I did this, if only I took them to the doctor, if only I encouraged them to give up smoking, to have more exercise, to take more rest. We always feel guilty. When you lose a job, you think, if only I'd worked harder, I should have known. Or if there's a separation in your life, a loved one, a husband, a wife, or just a partner leaves you, we think, I should have done better. So often, isn't it the case, we blame ourselves? This is not understanding life. Sometimes it's good to look upon this human life like a school. In school, it's not fun. Otherwise, if it was fun, you wouldn't need to have holidays. I mean, today is the end of the school term, isn't it? If school was really fun, the kids will want to go there on Saturday and Sunday as well. How many children volunteer to go on Saturday and Sunday and during holiday time? But we go to school, why? To learn. And this is like life. We're in this life to learn. And how do we learn? We learn from our mistakes. And what we really learn from is from suffering. Suffering whenever we hurt, physically or mentally, it shows that there's some mistake we've made, as it were. We've misunderstood something. We got something wrong. This is where we learn. And in fact, without pain and suffering, we would learn precious little. When we understand that life will have some suffering, that life will have some things happen to us which we don't like, which we don't want, we understand it's the same as at school. We get lessons when we don't really want them. We have homework where we'd rather watch the TV. We have to do these things because we know that it's in our long-term interest. However, some kids at school are very slow learners. And when you're a really slow learner, you have to keep on doing the year again and again and again. Some people, grade one, and they fail, they have to do grade one all over again, and all over again, and all over again. Sometimes people live their human life and they still don't learn. And so they have to do it all over again, all over again, all over again, in the many cycles of rebirth, in many lives you live, until you really learn. This human life, its meaning, its purpose, is for us to learn. What sort of things do we learn? We learn just these Four Noble Truths. What is suffering? And the end of suffering is happiness. Very few people know what happiness is. People think that happiness is going out to the casino, going and watching the World Cup football. How many millions of people, the last couple of weeks have been watching soccer? If not soccer, AFL or tennis or whatever else. I used to be stupid like that. But I used to follow a team which always lost. And out of despair, I became a monk. I was only joking there. But I noticed that whenever there was a competition, that there may be 30 or 40 teams playing, and only one team would go home happy. And everyone else would suffer for weeks, for months, they get depressed. And the one team which went home happy, after one or two days, they forgot about it all. So you've got something like the World Cup. I don't know how many teams are playing. Say there's like 30 teams playing. 29 of those are going to go back to their countries suffering. And all the people in those countries are going to suffer. One team is going to win, and for one or two days they're going to be happy. And afterwards, they're going to suffer. Why do they suffer? Because as soon as you win, you have to win again. That's the suffering. You have to keep up your reputation. So people don't know what happiness is. If they knew what happiness is, I've often said it to some of the people, I want to start a Buddhist football team. In a Buddhist football team, we know what happiness is. If the opposition wants to score a goal, we give them the ball. Compassion. And if they can't do it themselves, we score the own goal for them. We have much more fun that way. Because is winning fun? Or is there something else which is fun? Now what we're saying here is that in life we have all these experiences to learn from. Let's get more serious. The things which really hurt people are usually like deaths of loved ones. Because people can grieve for a long time. Or sort of separations. You know, when you have a partner you've loved very much and they leave you for one reason or another. When your kids are in trouble. These are the things which really hurt. You know, sometimes people, I mentioned the word suffering. People always think of like physical pain. But, you know, mental pain is far greater than any physical pain. Just recently, in January, February, I went to visit India. The holy place is there. But also on the trip, we had a walk around some of the poor areas of Benares. And there you saw some terrible things. You know, things which you never ever see in Australia. You see like lepers, real ones, who no one was looking after. They were wearing rags. The sort of things which you wouldn't even put in your dustbin. They were so bad. And they had sores. You could see the weeping sores from their bodies. They had no home to go to. They just slept out in the streets. And this is like India. It's not very healthy. But of those people who are physically just so poor and suffering with illness, of those people, they never committed suicide or killed themselves. But I've known quite a few people here. Australians, healthy, rich, young, with so many things before them, with no physical suffering, who have committed suicide, who have hung themselves in a park, overdosed on drugs, deliberately, have killed themselves. The mental suffering of those people has been so great, they could stand it no longer. It's very rare that physical suffering gets to that degree. Mental suffering often reaches just the limit where you can tolerate it no longer, and people decide to take their own life. When we're talking about suffering, sheer pain, what occurs in your mind, which no one else can see, is far greater than the pain in the body, no matter how great that is. Because of that, we understand that these experiences of life, which give us despair, that's when we see sort of the nitty-gritty of suffering. And where does that actually come from? It comes from not understanding this thing we call life. Because we expect what life can never give. That's why we get despondent. We expect when we fall in love with another person that this love will last forever. When we meet the partner which we really love, we say, darling, I'm going to love you forever and ever and ever. If you're a Buddhist, for many, many lifetimes. And we actually think that at the time. But what's the truth? Whatever comes together, one day must pass. We never think that. We even think, let alone other people, we even think that we are going to last forever. How many people think they're going to die tonight? You know, sometimes I look around here and I count the people. I said this before. Maybe there's 250 people here, 300 people. According to statistics, at least 3 or 4 of you will die within the next 6 months. Which 3 or 4 are they? Hey, which ones are they? Hey, some of you. Not the old ones. Young ones die as well. Are you ready? Now the thing is, we don't expect it, do we? Even though statistics, science, logic, reason tell us that we must die sometimes. We don't accept it. We put our heads in the sand. We think that life is going to go on forever. We think that our partners are going to always be there, our children are always going to be there, that life is fun. And when it's otherwise, we think something's gone wrong. One who is wise, and I've said this before, if something ever, if you ever get sick, there's a death or a tragedy, if you ever say, and come up to me and say, Ajahn Brahm, something's gone terribly wrong, straight away I'll say, you're not understanding the truth. Something's gone right. This is nature. If you ever go to the doctor and say, something's wrong with me, you don't understand Buddhism. When you go to the doctor and you're feeling terrible, something's right with me, doctor, I'm feeling terrible today. Something's right with me, doctor, I've got the flu. Something's right with me, doctor, so that I'm about to die. It'd be very strange, in fact wrong, if you're always healthy and live forever and ever and ever and ever. That'd be really weird. When we understand what life is, we're not shocked when life just does its thing. When somebody dies, we understand this is life. We come into this world according to our karma, our past actions, and some of those past actions, which we cannot see, they work out their rules and their laws. Sometimes we die young, sometimes we die old. Sometimes we die after a very lovely life, sometimes after a very difficult life. This is life. But the point is, once we accept life, once we understand it, or rather, once we experience life, we have to understand it. Once we understand it, we can accept it and learn to live with it. Once we know what's going on, we can adapt to life. We can adapt what we want. You know, like this, I say mentally, there's often a war goes on inside each one of you. It's the war between the way life is and the way we want it to be. And we always struggle so hard to make the world conform to the way we want it to be. I want to be liked. I want to have my loved ones around me. I want never to have a death. I don't want any rain when we're having a rain retreat ceremony on Sunday. I want everything just to be just right. I want all my newsletter articles to be on time. Anything like this, we want all these things to happen, but what actually happens? The newsletter articles are in late. It rains when I don't want it to rain. People say the wrong things. The company goes bankrupt. The stock market crashes. Our team loses the competition. Welcome to real life. We learn from suffering. In Buddhism, when someone comes up to me and they say they've got a terrible problem, I give them only a little bit of sympathy. Because if you just give them too much sympathy, you're not really helping them. Instead of saying, oh, poor thing, sorry, it's terrible that news you've had. Instead of just saying that, I say, what are you doing about it? Because just getting sorrowful about the sufferings in life is not practicing the Four Noble Truths. There is a way out. That way out comes through understanding and learning about suffering. I give a simile very often to people. It's been a long time, I think, since I've given this simile in a public talk. It's a simile of the truckload of dung. In this simile, it's as if you come to a place like this and have a lovely evening. Or maybe you go out to have a meal in some lovely restaurant. And you go back home feeling so happy and elated, and you find right in front of your front door of your house, of your beautiful house in your garden, somebody has dumped a truckload of dung. And it's smelly. There's two things about that truckload of dung. The first thing is, you didn't order it. The second thing is, no one saw it coming, so you can't tell anyone to take it away. You're stuck with it. I think that those of you know this simile. Know the truckload of dung stands for the suffering which we all experience from time to time in life. And to us, it appears that we didn't order this. The separation we have to endure, the death of a loved one, the failure in an exam, or some sickness which comes to us, some disappointment in life. We think, why me? I didn't order this. Why did it happen to me? That's the first thing. The second thing is we can't get anyone to take it away. Somebody is dead. We want them to come back to life again. It cannot happen. We come to a monk or to a priest or a counselor or just to a good friend. We want them to take away our pain. No one can take it away for you. You're stuck with it. Now, with a truckload of dung, in this simile, there's two things which people do. The first thing they do is they put bits of dung in their pockets, in their bags, up their shirts, and they carry it around with them. And you find if you carry around dung, you lose a lot of friends. What that means is that if you get negative, angry, guilty about what's happened to you, blaming life, blaming yourself, blaming something, feeling sorry for yourself about the suffering which happens in life. Isn't it so that after a while people don't want to be with you? No one likes to be with someone who's suffering. They want to be with someone who's smiling, who's happy. Everyone likes to be with happy people. No one likes to be with sour pusses. Now, that's one way of dealing with dung. The other way we're dealing with dung is a wise way. Dung is fertilizer. You get your wheelbarrow and spade, put all the dung in the wheelbarrow, and take it round the back and dig it in. Dig it into your garden. Maybe you can only manage one wheelbarrow a day, but you have the endurance and patience, because that's the only thing you can do with dung, to dig it all in. And one day it happens that all the dung has gone, you've dug it all in, and around the back in your garden, you've got this amazing garden there. The flowers are just so fragrant that they can smell all down the street. And if you've got fruit trees there, the fruit is just so delicious, so succulent, that when you give it to all your neighbours, instead of sort of accepting it grudgingly, like they usually do, they can't wait to accept the beautiful fruit from your garden. In that simile, you grow the beautiful flowers of compassion, the beautiful fruits of wisdom and understanding. Because if life's experiences, which are difficult, whether it's a separation, a death, a disappointment, an addiction, if you've really been there and gone through it and learned to dig in all that suffering into your garden, then you really know, you understand what it's like, and also how to get through it. And you've got the garden in the back to prove it. Then you can really help other people. Then you really can be compassionate to others. Because you can talk to them and you can truly say, I know how you feel. How many times have people, when you've been suffering, people say, I know how you feel. And you know they're lying. But they're just trying to be kind. When someone comes and they really do know, how much they can help you. They've dug in that dung. They've worked with it. They've learned from it. They've understood it. They've become wise from it. They've used suffering. These are the beautiful people in life. The wise ones, the truly compassionate ones. Anyone who understands that simile, the truckload of dung. Next time a truck comes up and dumps its dung, whoopee! Some more dung in my life to learn from. I can make an even greater garden in the back. Whenever there's a disappointment, suffering, you know how to use it. Because those trucks are going to come sooner or later to everyone's house. And they just dump, dump, dump. When we learn how to learn, when we learn from these things, it's amazing, they stop dumping. When you've learned your lesson, when you've learned about life, when you've learned about suffering, and how to deal with it, it's as if the lesson's over. You graduate. What's the purpose of a school anyway? It's to get out of there. To pass the exams and to graduate. The purpose of life is to learn about life. To learn enough to understand fully what this human existence is like so you don't have to come back again. Graduate from this school. However, that people sometimes are very silly and stupid. The Lord Buddha gave the simile once of different types of horses. Some horses, when they're getting trained, you know, the horse rider has to have a little whip or a bit of a stick. Some horses are so smart, even when the shadow of the whip falls across their body, they do exactly what they're told. Some horses are not so smart. They have to be just tapped very lightly once, and then they do the right thing. Some horses are even more stupid. Just have to be whacked once, and oh, then they learn. Some horses are so stupid, whack, 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 and they still don't learn. Which horse are you? How many times do we have to experience these things before we truly understand what the problem is? How many times do you have to go to a funeral of your loved ones? How many times do you have to cry before you understand what life is all about? Death happens at any time. Separation happens at any time. And basically, it's not your fault. You can't do anything about it. It goes according to nature. This is life. One of the stories I tell at funerals is a beautiful story of this monk who was staying in the forest. There was a storm in the forest he was staying in. He was afraid of his life. In the morning, he went outside. Many trees had fallen down, almost flattened his hut with him inside of it, but fortunately they didn't. He noticed on the ground of the forest were many leaves torn from the tree by the fierce winds the night before. The leaves which he saw on the forest floor were mostly old brown leaves. Amongst those old brown leaves were a few yellow leaves. There were even some green leaves, but only very few. And he looked even closer, and there were one or two fresh green leaves, which would have only sprouted the day before, torn by the wind off the tree. He looked up to see what leaves were left. What do you expect? Mostly green leaves. But even though young, fresh green leaves had been torn off, there were still a few old brown curly leaves still clinging on. And he thought, this is exactly the same as human beings. Even though when the wind of death takes many people, it does usually take the old brown leaves. It also takes some young people as well. And you see that even though young people die, there's still some old brown curly people still clinging on. 80, 90, 100, 110. After he understood what was going on, he never thought after that something's gone wrong when young green leaves get torn off, leaving old brown leaves still clinging on there. He thought, this is just nature. This is nature's way. And basically, you can do nothing about it. Except to be at peace and understand there's a waste of time fighting, complaining, crying at something which you can never change. The Buddha said the second noble truth is like craving. Unwise craving. Craving for things which you can never have. Isn't that suffering? We want something which life can never give us. We want to live forever. We want it always to be sunny. We want our team to always win. We never want to see death. We never want to see disappointment. We want life to go just our way. That sort of craving is senseless. It's stupidity. Life will never be like that. It can never give you that. This is why people suffer. Because they don't understand what life can give you. It's like a person joining the army. If you join the army, you're going to get shot at. That's what it's like being in an army. It's like a person going to the casino. If you go to the casino, you're going to lose. It's obvious. Just think of all the people who have to be paid to keep that place going. And where does it come from? It comes from all the people losing there. You go to the casino, you're going to lose. If you join a competition, the chances of you winning are very small. Understand the odds. Know the laws of the game. And then you will never complain as a soldier if you get shot. If you take human life, you're going to get old and you're going to die. That's par for the course. So if a soldier complained, why am I getting shot? If you go to work, why do they pay you anyway when you go to work? It's a bribe, isn't it, to get you to work? No one likes working. So if you complain about work, then you're not understanding what work is all about. So once you understand what life can give you, once you understand the cause of the problem is misunderstanding, then you understand that a lot of suffering can be let go of by flowing with life rather than trying to make it something it can never be. And it's the same with you, trying to make yourself something you can't be, rather than at least learning to accept yourself as you are. There you find a greater sense of peace and happiness. And happiness, the opposite of suffering. At some time in our life, sometimes in our life, we do experience moments of happiness. What are those moments of happiness? It's very interesting to actually observe experientially, not what other people say are happiness, but what you experience as happiness. What are the happiest experiences of your life so far? Now, sometimes people say like falling in love is happiness. Why do they say that? A lot of times it's because, you know, there is at least a semblance of selflessness in falling in love with another person. For a while anyway, you don't think of yourselves, but you're thinking of somebody else. But that sort of romantic love is very complex and complicated. But if it really was true love, if you really were thinking of the other person, you'd be happy if the other person was going out with somebody else. They're happy. But that's not real selfless love, is it? Sometimes selfless love is for parents or for children. You know that somebody once, I can say this myself. It might shock you, but it's very true. You know some of the happiest moments of my life when I was young? Before I was a monk, this occurred. I've got to be honest about this. Some of the happiest moments of my life before I was a monk was in the arms of another man's her wife. It was my mother. Got ya. It was true when I was a baby. I think I read that in the Reader's Digest somewhere. You can try that out on your friends tonight when you go back home. In the arms of another man's wife, my mum. Anyway, like the love towards children or towards parents, now that's getting much more selfless than the love towards a spouse or a mate. And it's interesting, isn't it, that the love to your partner, to your husband or your wife, now that does change. But your love towards your children, it's amazing, no matter what your child does. You know, things which you wouldn't tolerate in your husband, your child can do and you still love them. things you'll never tolerate in your wife, your daughter can do, and they're still your daughter and you'll always welcome them home. That's a love which is much stronger and deeper, much more selfless. And very often people find a lot of happiness, you know, in their children, in their grandchildren, or even in their parents. Why is that a type of happiness? And again, I've already mentioned the major word, the selflessness of it. When you don't desire anything for yourself, you just want to give to somebody else. Here we're starting to learn about this third noble truth, the opposite of suffering. You know, one of the reasons why people are really so stressed out in this world, and why they sometimes get so depressed, is because they think about themselves too much. Social service, going out doing something for the community, whether it's a Buddhist society, the salvos, old people's homes, visiting hospices, or doing something for society, is a marvelous source of happiness. It's selflessness. It's not just to your own kids, it's to other people. It's widening that experience of love. It's not what I want, it's what they want. Not selfish craving, but selfless work for the community. Those people who can do a lot of that will find immense happiness. I tell a story as a student. Even though I was a student working quite hard, once a week I used to go to a hospital for mentally disabled people. Just for an afternoon I used to work there. And for 2 years, you know, just helping out in little ways, it was a very great learning for me to be able to, you know, as a heterosexual young man, being able to learn to be hugged by other men. You know, these were mentally unstable. They saw you coming and they recognized you, and their emotions, you know, were just out of control, and they just came up and just gave you a big hug because they were happy to see you. And, you know, according to, you know, English society in those days, that was really a no-no. And I learned a lot from those people. Those friends, I would call them. And it did happen. I was doing my final examinations. They're coming up in a couple of weeks. And they gave me a presentation. And it was just so moving, just I almost cried. I think I actually did shed a tear there. And they said, you know, that of all the students who've come here to do some help, they told me that I've been here the longest and the most consistent, coming every week no matter what happened. And they gave me a little presentation. It was just so moving. But what was really moving was at the end, I said, well, thanks very much, but even though the final examinations are next week, they don't start till the day after next Wednesday when I went. Can I come next week, please? Can I please come? And even though it was the day before doing the examinations, I really wanted to go. It wasn't service for me. It was like happiness. I enjoyed going out there. It really made me sort of think, afterwards, what did I get out of that? Now, I got out a lot of happiness out of not thinking about what I wanted to do that day, but of doing something for somebody else, giving myself completely to somebody else. Service to others, practicing selfless compassion, is starting to understand what happiness is. But even more than selfless compassion, I found that in meditation was even deeper levels of happiness. Why is it that people come here, spend Friday evening just sitting quietly, crammed into this little room? Why is it people carry on meditating? It's because when you do get into peaceful meditation, there's a beautiful sense of happiness there. And the deeper you get into meditation, the more that happiness blossoms. Why? Why is there happiness in just sitting here, just watching the present moment and saying nothing? As a young man, I would have thought this is the most boring way to spend an evening. You know, some people actually come to our monastery for their holidays, and they tell their friends, where did you spend your holidays? Was it Bali? Was it going to Disney World or Club Med? I say, actually, it's a type of club meditation at Bodhidharma Monastery. And they said they went to the monastery for the weekend.
What did you go there for?
Are you some sort of religious nut? And they said, no, I go there because it's happiness.
What do you mean happiness?
What do you do there? Just just go and watch the TV or have games or sort of have a party and drink? No. I used to go and teach up at the prison. And one of the prison officers took me back and gave me a ride back and said, I always wanted to ask you guys, because he passes the monastery every day. He said, what do you guys do up there? And he said, do you have any women? Now, come on, honestly. It's really true. I said, no. And he said, do you have any alcohol? I said, no, we don't have any alcohol. And he couldn't figure out, well, what do you do? Any television? No television. What do you guys do up there? I said, we meditate. And he got really interested when I said that meditation is much happier than all those other things. And each one of you has actually touched that sort of happiness. Why is that happy? Because you're letting go of a lot of suffering. When you're meditating, to get really peaceful, what's the secret? No desire. That's the secret of meditation. Not wanting to go here, not wanting to go there. Being so desireless for these few moments, you can't even say anything. Completely content, desireless. The more desireless you can be in your meditation, the happier you are. Isn't suffering wanting something else? Wanting to be somewhere else? Wanting this moment to be different than it actually is? In meditation, you're just happy for this moment to be just as it is. The more content you can be, the more blissed out you become. There, you're learning about the third noble truth. How about what is the end of suffering? The path to the end of suffering, I've already told it. Morality, virtue. Sometimes people think you have to keep morality and virtue so you can go to heaven when you die. Or they do it as long as in public you keep your morality and virtue. But when no one's watching, you can go and misbehave. Sometimes people do that. If there's no speed cameras on the road, they feel they can speed. If no one's looking, they can misbehave. That's why some people, they go on these diets. And when they're back in their bedroom, they stuff all this chocolate in their mouths because no one can see them. But look, it's all of this, virtue, morality, it's done for the sake of happiness. So look at what the monks do. We give up sex, we give up alcohol, we give up TV, we give up going to entertainments. When I first heard about all these things as a monk, I thought these monks must be really unhappy, stuffed up, mentally incompetent, and all these other things when I first heard about all these rules as a monk. But when I first saw my monk, the first monk I saw, I was amazed just how happy they were. I couldn't believe, how can you be so happy? When all these things which life says is happiness, the freedom to travel, to have money, to have relationships, to have a family, to have a TV and a CD, you don't have any of these things. But how can you be happy? That really intrigued me when I first saw my first monk. They smiled a lot. How on earth can you guys do that? You're supposed to be not enjoying yourselves. Yes, you don't have any things which I used to think were enjoying. You can't go to rock concerts. You can't go and get drunk. But I saw that there was another happiness there. The first part of that happiness was the happiness of virtue. And certainly in my life I've seen that so clearly. If you live a good life, where you don't harm or hurt other people, you don't lie, you don't steal, you don't say unkind words, you don't hurt your own body with alcohol or drugs, when you don't kill or steal or hurt other beings at all, at the end of the day, you feel so happy about yourself. You feel free from any conscience of bad actions. and everyone does have a conscience. I found this out in jail. All the prisoners, even the most hardened ones I knew when I went to jail very often to teach meditation there, even the most hard, tough guys would come up to me after I'd known them for a while and say, I feel terrible about what I've done. They wanted someone to tell that to. But they couldn't tell it to the officers, they couldn't tell it to the prisoners, they couldn't tell it to anyone else because that's not the social system there. That's not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to be tough in jail. You're supposed to be hard. It's only when you gain a person's confidence that they can show their real feelings. The most hardened prisoners had those feelings, only they very rarely showed them to anyone except people they could really, really trust. And I was actually quite flattered and honoured they could trust me. Everyone has that conscience. You have that conscience. And if you've done something wrong, something which you know has hurt somebody else, you feel terrible about it. It hurts. If you're free from that immorality, that free from that lack of kindness, that lack of virtue, that lack of goodness, if you're free of that, you feel a great happiness. The Buddha called that the Anuvajrasukha, the faultless happiness. You're finding one way of ending suffering. When you look at your life, at the end of your life, and you know you've lived a very good life, you've done your very best, you die so happily. You do go up to a heaven realm because you've lived a good life, and that directly gives you happiness. You've lived a bad life, you've done something wrong you haven't asked forgiveness for. That really eats at you, causes you pain, suffering. That's the first part of the Eightfold Path, the way which leads out of suffering. It's being a good person. You're good for the sake of happiness here and now. Second part of the Noble Eightfold Path is the meditation. Peace is great happiness. We have to spend a lot of our time working, doing things in the world. There comes a time at the end of the day when we should find some peace. At the end of the week, peace. At the end of our life, some peace. You find that peace through meditation. To be able to let go of the past. To be able to be still. Rest. Take a break from doing things. And there you find enormous happiness. People ask me why I'm a monk. For the happiness of peace. Why are there so many monks at our monastery? 15 this year, and 2 novices, and 1 nun. Why are so many people there? Because they've enjoying the happiness of peace. What do they do all day? They just bliss out on peace. How much does it cost? Nothing. What are the bad side effects? Nothing. In fact, the good side effects, which gives rise to the next part of the Eightfold Path, wisdom. Because when your mind is very peaceful, you can see clearly. When you can see clearly, you understand what life is all about. You understand what life can give and what life can't give. You understand you're going to be successful for a while, but it won't last. Impermanence. You can build a beautiful monastery. It won't last. You can have a nice healthy body, but it won't last. You can give a nice talk, but it won't last. You don't expect it to last forever. And so when it ends, you expected it, you're at peace, and you never suffer. When you understand impermanence, when you understand not self, you're not in control of all of this. Just sit back and enjoy the ride. Then you don't suffer. So this is the Four Noble Truths. Simile of the truckload of dung, the way of happiness, the way of suffering. Reflect on these teachings, and you'll find they'll liberate you from so many difficulties and problems in life, and they'll lead stage by stage into deeper levels of happiness as you learn all the lessons of life, as you graduate through this school, so you never have to come back to school again and do all this homework and always be sent to the headmaster for some sort of punishment when you don't understand what life is all about. So may you all understand very quickly and be free from all suffering and bliss out and have a happy life. That's the last talk I'm going to give for a while. So, there's any questions about this evening's talk on the Four Noble Truths? Okay, there we go.